little we know about everything, I think. I don't know. Maybe that's also something that's pandemic really taught me, of being like, we don't know anything. We literally, like, science is grasping at straws. You know?
On that note, like, it's interesting, like, connection with like ghosts and spirits, like, is so widely like ruled out as like crazy, while medicine, you know, is this like legitimate thing. But like, it's both, like, all of it is just at the core examining death and like different ways, different frameworks. And I don't know, there's no way to say that like one isn't I don't know, they're both legitimate in their own ways, I think.
Can you hear me, Chris, by the way? Is my microphone working?
Yeah.
I played with the levels a little bit. I think one thing that we have to admit related to what Dee was saying is that we don't know everything. We can't ever know everything, and we kind of just have to surrender to that, because I feel like that is the big source behind, well, any fear is like the unknown, you know, and that we don't know it and that we can't grasp it. And sometimes you just have to surrender to the lack of control and the lack of knowing, because we crave to know more. We crave to research things, like the whole like enlightenment philosophy of like knowledge and wanting to know every single thing that we could, but there's just some things I don't think we'll ever be able to grasp, and I feel like that is the key to grasping it. Yeah, that's all. Dee looks like she has something to say.
Oh, well, I thought I found a quote that I really like, if I could read it in the next talking segment, if you guys want to see. Yeah, it was one of my favorite parts of the book, was to realize that we suffer because we see ourselves as permanent and separate is so important. Compassion flows from the realization that we are not separate and have no fixed identity. We have let ourselves, when we let ourselves love, we no longer resist the suffering of others. Lama Lordro Dorje, sorry if I butchered that, reminds us that love is a meltdown. That meltdown establishes a more unified space of brilliance, goodness, and sadness. When we no longer protect ourselves from others' suffering, we experience it simply as suffering, not mine or yours, just as. And it's 5:02 in the morning, and you're listening to CQUT.
Thank you. What do you see? The sun is rising, most definitely. A new day is coming. Ooh, people are changing. Ain't it beautiful? Ooh, crystal blue persuasion. Better get ready. Gonna see you.
course, get soft. Do you remember the time? I don't know. In fact, about, I don't know, 3 years ago, that was fucking new and exciting. And, I don't know, hang out. There's been some trouble to each other like this. And they hug you out, you see a punk. Yeah, how you doing, man? How you doing? Yeah, what happened, man? These days, you got like new punk? I don't know, shit. God, how you doing?
Disappointed and sore.
Hello, it's around 5:30 in the morning and you're listening to CKET, William Shatner's Whiskey Tears. Right before the music that we just had, I read a segment from Being with Dying, which is Joan Halifax's book, and she was talking about love as a meltdown. And I was recently researching the Greek god of love, Eros, which is supposed to be the interconnectivity of everything in the world. Basically, the god that's at the beginning and the end and like the creation. It's like manifestation, the energy of connection and union. It's the secret glue. Like, this god is the secret glue that basically keeps everything together and wants everything to fuse together via desire and attraction. And that, like, desire and attraction is like not only like in the way that we usually think of it in sexually, but like just like anything that makes you want to be connected. And they oppose it to the Greek god Thanatos, which is the god of death. So I guess just like it was thinking about that, of these like Greek gods being opposed to each other, of like connection versus disillusion, and like the dissolving of the self that we kind of view in death. And how do you guys view compassion in your life, and do you think that it's helpful, or like how is love and compassion kind of fit into dealing with a life that has death on the other end?
Chris, would you like to go first?
Take it away.
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
It's a hard question to really think about in like such a short period of time. I'm trying to wrap my head around it. So viewing compassion, you say, in a world with death. Well, there's a few ways that you can look at it. I think for compassion and death for myself, it's about cherishing the relationships that you have and making, I guess, the most of that relationship that you can on, I guess, these ideas of mortality. It's something that I guess I think about quite a bit, is death. Like, it surrounds my everyday thinking and everything I do in my life. And for myself, at least, in certain relationships with friends, family, and whatnot, it could be one of the last times I ever see them, for example, or just a time that I'm with them, which is so limited. So for myself, at least, death and compassion, I think it gives me a way, death provides me, I guess, with more compassion for those around me, for my friends, for my loved ones, because my time with them is so limited and can be so limited. Yeah, I guess that's the best way I could really wrap my head around that. Was that what you were looking for?
I'm not looking for anything in particular. I'm just using this as an opportunity to unload heavy questions in a setting where people can't not answer because we're on the air. But yeah, I think I also view it as compassion when people make decisions that I don't view as always the wisest. I'm like, wow, these are also people just very much trying their best in a very absurd context that we have to live in. Like in a pandemic where I'm like, I was living with people who were very at risk for COVID for a year, and that I think put death at the forefront of my mind, of being very afraid when I left the house that I was going to accidentally kill a family member. But trying to still hold compassion for how hard this year was in any way, and not always get very angry, I think, of being like, fuck, or sorry, I did that. Oh, cool. It's late night radio. Okay, nice. But yeah, just like, damn, we can't, people are really trying their best, and to hold that compassion and hold love as a, what is it, love as, I don't know, an antidote for death. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer. And your response sparked a few things in myself. I think 2 points that it made me think of. One was not only this compassion within relationships of like spending time with those around me because it's so limited, but also I guess thinking for the other person and having compassion for them in the sense that I don't want others to suffer given that their life is so limited and their time is so limited. And of course, suffering is a part of our lives. And I think everyone needs to suffer, of course. But more just a compassion of wanting those around me to fulfill themselves and find happiness. It's like a little mantra that I tell myself sometimes when I do metta meditations, which are loving kindness meditations. And I like picture someone in my life that's important to me. It could be someone who I have a difficult relationship with or a not so difficult relationship with. And I just repeat, well, what my friend Sam Harris, who gives me guided meditations, tells me is to say, may you be happy and may you be free from suffering when thinking about that person. And yeah, that's just what came to my brain. And even with someone with whom it might be difficult to think of those things, I think it's a really good thing to think about, regardless, just to wish someone happiness and a lack of suffering at times. Another thing, what you just said made me think about of having compassion with those because things are hard, and everyone's just trying their best, is having compassion and love even for those you disagree with. I think it's a really difficult thing to do, and it's really easy to have strong feelings towards those you disagree with, whether it's politically or about any topic that you might be talking about. And yeah, it's just important to remind yourself that we're all just trying our best, and I think we're all just trying to think of the best things for everyone. Most people at least, and to just have compassion for those that you disagree with and some love in your heart. Yeah, I don't know.
Actually, I have something really relevant to that. I studied a lot of terror management theory when I was in my undergrad, and there's a lot of studies that are done where you prime someone with writing about their own death. And then give them, let's say you give a bunch of Americans like anti-American propaganda to read after, and they'll be very, very angry and very, very pro-American nationalist if they were primed with like writing about their death and when they're not. So like, how does worldview and like assertion of things that are causing a lot of harm to people, like white supremacy and US imperialism, Canadian imperialism, colonialism, like how do those things are asserted when people are afraid of dying and afraid of being wrong and afraid of time being wasted, is kind of what all these studies were looking at, which I found really interesting. And that more collectivist cultures, like there is a study that was done in Japan that I was reading, had it less. And it's more of an individualism thing. I don't know if anyone had any thoughts about that. But it was just reminding me of that, being like, wow, like people are really afraid of dying and about being wrong, you know? Hard to live with that. So how do you have compassion for those people? Or should you? I don't know. It's hard to have compassion for a white nationalist, honestly.
Chris, do you have anything to say?
Well, that's just a lot to the experiment, or the study is like a lot to wrap your head around. Maybe the thing that came to mind for me was maybe like writing about your death ahead of like whatever like the interview would be that like this white nationalism comes out, and maybe it has something to do with like a feeling of insecurity and wanting to like put stock in like this narrative that you as an American for some reason are like, you know, part of something great. Like you meant, like, because you have this association, you lived as like a white man in this American society, that like, you know, you were part of something greater. But like, it's like a, it's not anything about, you know, your true existence. Like it, like you're afraid. I feel like it reflects like a sort of fear of like insignificance or like powerlessness, which is like so antithetical to like traditional male thinking in America. I'm not sure if I fully understood like what the study, what like the experiment was, but like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, what you just said reminded me of another book. And I'm trying to remember the title. It's about death. And I know D has read it. It's Ernest Becker book. Yeah, that denial of death. And it's like the death project type thing, you know, is living for something greater. Yeah. But related to your question about having compassion for someone like a white nationalist, that's a really difficult question, I think, to ask. And a really hard question to answer.
Were these people being like these people that were being interviewed were white nationalists, regardless? And like some of them were asked to write about death.
Like they weren't white nationalists before?
As much as any American is a white nationalist.
Okay.
No, it was just like a random sample of American citizens.
That makes sense then.
And it brought up a lot of, I mean, the terror management theory basically has this idea that it's like kind of what you were talking about, self-esteem, of like you need self-esteem and a worldview as a buffer so you don't think about death. And I think I want a world where inviting death in is not as scary. So what would it be like for these people to invite, the strip back kind of like the intense response of asserting one's worldview and self-esteem on other people in a way that actually harms other people. And how do you actually change people's minds and like allow them to like grapple with their own mortality a bit better so that they can stop harming people, I guess, is like kind of what I've always wondered about. But that's a question that I don't think really has an answer all the time. Or I'm trying to be more open to like non-dualist answers to it, of like you can both have compassion and be pissed off and like not want to be associated with someone, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's really important, is not looking at things like you have to feel one way and only that way towards a person, that you can't simultaneously feel compassion and care for someone and at the same time pissed and super angry at what they're saying and completely disagree on so many levels. It's a really hard thing to do. Like I said, I think despite a lot of people being really shitty, I've had this conversation with a few friends, and it's like, even like you have people who are like pro-lifers, and I find looking at them through the lens solely of these are people trying to control bodies, for example, which is what they're doing through being pro-life. But at the same time, looking at it through the perspective of these people are trying to do what's best, although they might have a not so good conception. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Kind of. It's just that a lot of people are trying to think of the best things for humanity that aren't, and they're not good things, you know? It's hard to explain this point I'm trying to make. It's a really difficult point.
I totally feel what you're saying. Like, a lot of people think they know what's best for everyone, and then, you know, rules put in place by institutions made up of, like, you know, pretty homogeneous mixtures of people, like white men, mm-hmm. like they're going to reflect, like, that specific idea of what is best for everyone.
Definitely. I think the important thing is just trying to understand each other, you know. I think that's the most important thing, as difficult as it might be. We just, like, went on a completely different tangent, you know.
Yeah, I guess I'm a person that is trying to learn more and more about stuff like transformative justice, and not viewing people as disposable and not replicating the prison industrial complex in our own lives and trying to find things outside of that. But it's very hard when it's people that I simultaneously want suffering for, but like as like a gut impulse. So yeah, I right. guess just like, I think that looking into death is very important, because maybe, and like cultivating presence and in one's life and like more a better connection to the present and grappling with death, to then make people realize of like, all you have is now. So it's okay to change your mind, and it's okay to like think radically different. And it's okay to like, if we can have like systems that can like actually have people rehabilitate, then that would be really cool. But yeah, I think that's the key, is when you're talking about death, you're talking about literally everything. Literally.
Yep. This is a very true point. Like, I feel like every single thing, well, most things that we think about indirectly, even just go back to death. A lot of our ways of thinking, like even eating, like, it's to prevent us from dying, going to drink that glass of water. It's because you're going to die if you don't drink that glass of water. Like, literally everything we do is in the face of death. So, yeah, death is about everything. And on that note, yeah, let's get back into some music, because there's only about 13 minutes left in the episode. We could play, like, a tiny bit more music before just saying goodbye. Dee's just loading up a track, and then we're gonna get into the music. Yeah, that's a good one. I'll throw it on. So you're listening to Chris. It's 5:47 in the morning. What are we listening to?
It's William Shatner's Whiskey Tears on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Love. lemon of ink. Flowing velvet. The lemon of ink.
CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 5:56 in the morning. You've been listening to William Shatner's Whiskey Tears. How's it going, Zach?
It's going well. I think this has been a really good episode, honestly. One of my favorites, I'd say, ever. Definitely, I think, the best episode we've done in quite some time. We had some really good conversations. We had a great guest. Thanks to Dee for coming on the show. Dee, you got any final remarks for being on the show? It was a pleasure having you. You're a great guest, great conversations, solid music. What do you got to say?
Yeah, I'm happy with the, like I said, the cosmic timing, cosmic aligning of messaging you, being near your house, and being at a time double vaccinated to be able to come over feels like the best day.
Yep, it's the best day, and there's more best days ahead. That's for sure. Yeah, it was perfect timing that you messaged me. Super glad that you did and you came. I love last minute things. It's my favorite way of organizing myself and my life. I much prefer that over planning for some reason. And yeah, Chris, you got any final remarks?
I'm very much the same way.
You bet you don't like planning.
Yeah, spontaneous. That's where I joined in after, I don't even know how long, 10 minutes?
True. Well, let's be spontaneous right now. It's currently 5:57 in the morning. Chris, what station are we listening to and what are we about to hear?
It's CKUT 90.3 FM. About to be Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. It's Ladyfingers. Have a good morning.
Delightful morning to you, beautiful souls. You are listening to Estáis Escuchando Vos Écoutez, a multilingual affair here on CKUT 90.3 FM with Tequis, your reggae fusion artiste, lady who wears many wraps and colourful ones at that. We are here to empower you today with words of love, motivation and anything else in between. I have been discovering places and loving it.